Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's episode of the Dugout Debate Podcast. I'm Tim Husselbury.
And I'm Chris Kerr.
This week, we're going to be discussing a little talked about issue in modern day sport, but one that should certainly be brought into the limelight. Life after sport. This week, we are delighted to reveal we have a special guest on the podcast, Chris Bell.
Chris Bell had a 15-year professional rugby playing career spanning Harlequins, Leeds Tykes, now Yorkshire Carnegie, Sale Sharks and Wasps, where he finished his playing career due to a shoulder injury. He played 80 times for Wasps, including captaining them, and has since finishing his professional career has moved on to be Head of Partnership Delivery and Head of Off-Field Player Development at the club, which we are interested in this podcast.
Now I'll hand you over to Chris, so you can listen to the interview he had with Chris Bell earlier this week.
So welcome to our podcast, Chris. Thank you for coming along.
No worries, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. Can you tell me a little bit about your role at Wasps?
Since August 2015, I've been the Head of Off-Field Player Development, so I'm looking after that now alongside, at the moment, I'm alongside my Head of Partnership Delivery, which I've recently taken over since September. I'm now trying to help the players with their personal development away from the field. So I was employed in August 2015 to try and develop a programme that helps the players develop away from the rugby pitch and allows the transition out of the sport to be as smooth as possible. So, yeah, very challenging job. Quite new. Not all rugby clubs have somebody in post like myself. So it's something that we're trying to do and offer an extra benefit to the players.
And obviously, it's perfect for you because of your background. Obviously, being a former player yourself, you feel like you've got that experience as well that you can bring to the boys. You've gone through it yourself.
Yeah, I was really passionate about welfare as a player. I was a member of the RPA board for a couple of seasons, sat on the management board, which was really interesting. It was a great time to be involved. We helped do the new standard contract, increase injury provision. Unfortunately, I got injured before that actually took place, so didn't actually see the benefits of that. But yeah, very keen always in my career to try and explore new opportunities, trying to prep for the future, and also trying to improve player welfare. The players, they put a lot of effort in the game at the moment now. The physical demands and mental demands on the players is massive, and I think as a club we need to offer them support around that, away from that, and we need somebody outside of the players themselves to actually look forward.
Yeah, they do need the help outside of the rugby. It's not just about the rugby, they need the other stuff as well. And as you've mentioned, you obviously got injured out of the game as well, so how difficult was that transition going from playing to the other stuff afterwards?
Difficult, really difficult. I think I was chatting with somebody yesterday. I think all rugby players struggle. I think even professional, amateur, social, whatever you may be, when you stop playing a game you love that's been such a huge part of your life, it's a big hole to fill. It is a very difficult time. That can be magnified in the professional game because you lose your job and your income and your stability and everything on top of that as well. So as opposed to an amateur player who loses his hobby, but everything else carries on, as a professional player, if you're not prepared, you can pretty much lose everything. And it's unfortunate that that's actually happened to people. I was very lucky. I played for 14 seasons. I've got out of the game in relatively decent shape, so I don't have any injury hangovers. So I look at it as an event that happens. I can't change it. I really enjoyed my time. I had a great time at Wasps and all the clubs I played for. It was a difficult time, but I think I managed to transition very well. I was very lucky in terms of I had a role to go straight into, quite a challenging role and quite an interesting one as well. So it's it feels like a long time ago that I played, and it's coming up for about 3 years, but it definitely feels like a lot longer than that.
And just how difficult is it getting those boys ready for, as you said, you had something straight to go into? How difficult is it getting those boys ready to go straight into something after their playing career?
I always say to the players, they've got to provide the momentum, they provide the energy and the drive to execute these plans. Myself and the club and the RPA and everybody will help them as best they can, but they've got to actually get up and activate what we plan. So it varies from person to person, age to age. I always use the term a light bulb moment. I said most players will have a light bulb moment where something clicks and they're like, actually, I need to do something in the future. We've had some brilliant examples in the last couple of years at Wasps. We've had some very, very proactive players that have exited the game and moved on to a second career and have been brilliant at it and will be brilliant at it. So I think when you sign your first contract, you're accepting that I'm going to have to change my career at a certain point. That may come at your own decision. The majority of players, it's your coach won't re-sign you or injury hits. So it's very much something to prep from right from the first contract. So yeah, what we're trying to look at is help our academy players, help to manage their transition into the sport and make sure that they've always got half an eye on their transition out of the sport.
I guess that's more difficult sometimes for other sports. There'd be footballers, young footballers, that wouldn't really be thinking about that, whereas we're quite lucky that we've got rugby players that are thinking about education, further education straight away with university, etc. What are your thoughts on getting those kind of qualifications as well? They're vitally important, aren't they?
Hugely. And I think the nature of rugby being such a physical game, everybody matures at different rates. So people have to stay in school until 18 because they have to mature to that point. They can't play rugby, professional rugby, until they're 17. So that automatically gives them 2 more years in school than a footballer would take, because a lot of footballers will leave at 16 to pursue the goal. The financials are completely different, as we know. If you become a premiership footballer, the rewards are very, very high. The risk of not getting there is also very, very high. So I think rugby is hugely important. There's always been a good educational background in it. A lot of the good schools are good rugby schools. Traditionally, the universities were good rugby universities, and that was a path. We've now seen, since professionalism, players will leave school and go directly into rugby. We're trying to encourage as many as possible to link that up with studying, because for certain players, they may not be physically ready at 18. They may take a few more years to develop. If they can develop while they're playing good quality rugby at some top universities and getting a great education, it develops them as a person, and then they can come into the game at 21, 22. There's a number of good examples in our squad that have gone through the university route and are still where they need to get to. So timing's not necessarily massively important. Some players go professional and are stars at 18. Some take a little bit longer. So the university support is massive.
That's an interesting point you raised there. I guess it is new, all of this stuff, but we've only gone professional for the last 20-odd years. So it's something new that the guys would have thought about their professional lives as well as their rugby at the same time. Now we've got to suddenly think about, you've got a professional rugby career and you've got to do this stuff afterwards. That's a new challenge for rugby.
Hugely, yeah. I started in 2001 and I think the game went professional in 95, 96. So I started playing with the older players at that age and had a career. They'd come into rugby. We were rugby players that got paid, to be honest. It was nowhere near as professional as it is now. But they already had a career. They had a great experience in rugby, and then they went back to that first career, because majority of them, to get to where they were, had gone through rugby playing schools, had gone to rugby playing universities. So they were in quite a good set. I was a full-time rugby player straight from school. I studied with the Open University. I've studied with Northumbria University as well, looking to do some stuff for Coventry. So I had to study alongside my rugby, because the opportunity of being a full-time student and a full-time rugby player just wasn't feasible.
Yeah.
Some players can do it. I know myself well enough to know that I couldn't. So I studied in my part-time. So it's a new challenge. It's a new model. The old model and the traditional model can work for some people, but the fact it's traditional and it's generic from the majority, you're not dealing with the majority. You're dealing with highly specialised athletes that are expected to be top performers in a very unique field. So we've got to look at their development and their education in the same way. It's bespoke for each individual. It's not a one-size-fits-all. If we're trying to go down that offering, we're then trying to shoehorn people into the wrong holes. It's evolving. It's constantly evolving. But again, the drive from the players is massive. You have to be led by the players. There's a number of players at the club doing some great things with their education, primarily because that's what they want to do, and they've got enough drive to go and do it.
Yeah, and obviously we've got a very good relationship with universities here at Wasps. Something from a personal experience, we've managed to build that link with senior academy players where they get offered a university contract and they can go and do that for a couple of years. As you say, people develop at different times, so they'll be ready then to look at the rugby side of things once they've had their university career as well.
Yeah, hugely. And I think I say to the young, I was talking to the young player the other day, you should have a rugby, you have a rugby pathway and a personal pathway, and if they collide and they meet beautifully, then that's fantastic, but you shouldn't allow one to detract from the other. So what we're trying to offer to them is, we speak to our senior academy players on a regular basis, and we want to try and offer them top education, which we're very lucky to in this area. We're very close to Warwick, to Coventry, to Birmingham, to Loughborough, all commutable distance from our training ground, so they can go to a top university and study a subject of their choice, play great rugby, and if they're not a full-time professional, they can still come and train in pre-season, they can still play in our A-League, and we've still got contact with them, because you never know what's going to happen. So
yeah,
it's definitely something that we're looking to produce. The game as a whole, not just Wasps in general, but the game as a whole doesn't need to lose players at 18. You don't want to turn players off from rugby at that point of time. So if somebody has to goes to university rather than going into professional sport and comes to it at a later date, there's plenty of examples of players coming to the game late and they're succeeding.
Yeah. And personally, what would you say is the most difficult aspect of getting players employed post-career? Is it getting those qualifications in place early doors, where other people have maybe looked at that aren't doing rugby? And obviously we've got to do that on top of doing rugby. That's difficult for them, isn't it?
Yeah. Experience is always going to be an issue. You're always going to get to the point where you're going to go, depending on time. I talk about exit routes in the game. So you have an exit route at 18 when you don't go to the senior academy. There's probably another one at 21 where you haven't progressed from the academy to the first team. Generally, around 25 is when people take stock of, am I going to continue with this or step away from the game? And then through the grace of luck, if you get to the mid-30s, that's the natural kind of the end. So you're always going to be, depending on where you are on that journey, depending on who you're up against in terms of competition for that job, you may be in your mid-30s going for a fairly senior job, but no actual experience in the industry you're going into. So a big challenge for the CV is to make sure that your CV is as broad as possible, is as complete as possible, and you've identified the industry that you want to go into. Then you can put the qualifications, then you can get the experience on a part-time basis. So you're at least showing to your employer that there's definite will in there, and you've managed to study and work at the same time of being a professional rugby player. It can be quite a strong message. Again, that's quite difficult. It takes a lot of time and effort from the players. So it's about them understanding what they want to do and why they want to do it, or understanding what they're good at, and then linking what they're good at to a career that they'll enjoy.
And do companies see the merit of rugby in that it really fosters teamwork and leadership in people as well? Do people like employing rugby, former rugby players?
Yeah, definitely. So there's huge amounts of evidence in terms of transferable skills from sports to business. I'm a big believer in there's transferable skills the other way. I think players, while they're playing, should go and spend time in business and look at what can I learn from top business leaders, what can I learn from top performers in businesses, and how can I transfer that back again? But if you look at all the top skills and just the adaptability, the drive, the determination, the teamwork ethos, the humility that a lot of the players have, it's a very, very valuable skill that a lot of employers want to get hold of. We need players to blaze a trail. We need players to come through the program. We need players to go and do some great things so that when the next player comes along and they come from rugby and they come from Wasps and they come from the kind of family of people that they know from, the person employing them will know what they're going to get and what kind of skills and attributes they're bringing.
Yeah, and obviously the RPA plays a really important role for the boys as well. As you've mentioned, you were involved with it in your career as well.
Yeah, the RPA are really, really helpful. I've had great connections with the RPA for a very long time. They've helped me on good and bad issues. It's a fantastic union. They put a lot of time and effort into developing the players. We're very lucky at Wasps. We've had Ben McGregor last year, who was fantastic, who's now head of the programme. And we've got Jake Abbott this year, who's a brilliant PDM. So it's a huge support for me. We look at a very collaborative approach. So there's no turf war. We're not fighting over players. Ultimately, we want the players to develop. So wherever they've got the best development opportunity and who can handle them the most, we'll step up and lead that project. So I can't endorse the RPA enough. I think they're a fantastic organisation. And they're always continually looking to improve what they're offering.
Yeah. And which players, you've mentioned some already, which players would you say are most proactive in looking out and making sure they set themselves up for that post-career work?
The most visible is probably James Haskell. You don't have to go onto social media just to realise. James, his enthusiasm and his drive is infectious. His want and his will to succeed is fantastic. He's been involved in everything and for a long time, but he's got very clear goals in terms of what he's trying to do. Matt Simons has been very impressive. Sam Jones, Elliot Daly. There's a number of Kinnan Marl has just completed a degree with the Open University and he's looking to go on to a master's. James Gaskell has done some really good things. I'm only kind of cherry picking a few. There's the majority of the players are really active and engaged and are looking to do something else. The ones that aren't are probably the standouts. 10 years ago you were probably a standout if you were doing something, whereas now I think the culture's shifted, so if you're not doing anything and you're only doing rugby, you're probably one of the standout players. So yeah, we're very lucky. We've got a very driven group. We support them as best we can. I'll support them any way I can. The club will support them as well. Dai is definitely behind the programme. He endorses it as well. So it's you don't get time off training, which you wouldn't expect to, but they always want to know what's going on and how we're providing extra benefits to the players.
And as you said, the club can really help as well. Like Matt Simons recently had that event with Purity, didn't he? That's obviously a club sponsor and they've helped him in that way and he's been engaged in helping them as well. That cohesion is really good between the two.
Yeah, Matt's fantastic. So Matt decided that he wanted to put on an event around the Autumn Internationals. He came to me with an idea and a plan. Him and I had both been to many of these events before. He wanted to look at it from a charity angle to raise money for Restart, which is a phenomenal charity. They've helped Ed Jackson massively in the past year, and Ed is obviously an ex-Wasp and a good friend of ours. So Matt came with his plans. This is what I'd like to do. Do you know anyone that can help? Purity are a fantastic partner. They've been with us for 3 years now. Really looking to embed those relationships. Paul Halsey, their founder, is a rugby man through and through. Sat down with Matt and they devised a plan and they executed a brilliant event on the Saturday just gone. So we're very lucky at this club. We've got a very good engaged bunch of partners, family partners, I should say, sorry. They're fantastic. They're willing to help. When a player comes to them with the drive and the plan and the determination to succeed, they will go above and beyond to make sure they can help facilitate that. So yeah, that was really pleasing. So I'm pleased it went really well. I'm sure Matt's going to debrief that properly and then we'll look to plan the next ones.
Very good. And for those that it doesn't quite go so well, the RPA are also there for those that struggle with the mental health side of things after they've got just launched their Lift the Weight campaign as well. So I guess that's another important side of it for the guys that are going to struggle with that mentally. Such a big switch at the end of your sports career to go in and do an office job, sit behind the desk every day, it's completely different. So they're there for that, and obviously you help those guys with that as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm by no means a trained counsellor in any way, shape or form, but I'm always on hand to speak to the players if they need to. They say I've been through that transition myself. I know it can be difficult at times. A lot of it is a culture change and a culture shift, and the players need to expose themselves to new cultures and new ways of working before it actually comes on them. Resilience is an interesting topic. Mindfulness and resilience, I think, is good. Nick DeLuca was a real champion of that. He was fantastic in terms of that, and he's taken that into the school that he's in. So it's really interesting to see how that progresses, because I think he could be a real trailblazer in that environment. Resilience is very interesting. It's essentially, in my view, I think, is adaptability. So how can you make yourself adaptable to survive certain situations? Within rugby, there is almost like a he-man macho atmosphere, and you need that at times. It's a very physical sport, and you need to hide those kind of injuries and whatnot when you're playing against other people. But you need to develop resilience. You need to develop skills to make yourself adaptable, because just because you've ended one career and you've been relatively successful doesn't mean you're going to be a complete flop in the next. So you've got to harness those skills. You've got to understand what your core capabilities are and how you can actually put those to a job. So a lot of that is understanding, do they like the job? What are they good at? What are their competencies? What are their core capabilities? And how can we align those to their future roles? Because a lot of other people, this is a sweeping generalization, but a lot of other people will often go for two or three jobs until they find their perfect one.
Yeah.
If a player is transitioning later in their career, later in their life, they might not have two or three options. They may only have one chance, possibly two if you're lucky. So finding out what that job is and using up those chances before you need them is quite a good piece of advice.
Yeah, and we have had unfortunate examples of Gary Speed in football where he hasn't been able to live with that move, and he did commit suicide. But we've had people come out, even like Andrew Flintoff, as big a name as that's come out and said he did struggle with that change from going out and obviously touring the world with England to a lesser job. But obviously he's found his niche in TV, so it could be it could be anywhere. But I guess the important thing is that you do come out and tell people that maybe you are struggling and look for that help, because there are loads of people out there to help you.
Yeah, the RPA have Cognacity. They've got a fantastic opportunity there. So if anybody needs any help, they're completely independent, discretionary, you know, advice. They are fantastic. We need to develop a culture where if people are struggling on those kind of things, they need to be able to speak about it and need to be able to help. The club's always willing to listen. The club's always willing to help. The RPA and the governing body and the RFU do some great work in that as well. So I think it's been spoken about more. I think mental health for a long time was just thrown under the carpet, and the words toughen up were used, which you can look at in a physical point of view, but when you're coming to some of the more mental issues, you can't.
That's not going
to
help.
No, that's not an approach that you need. So there's a long way. We're doing some good stuff in the game. I think we are doing some really good stuff, but there's obviously a long way to go.
Yeah, there's always going to be learning points, I guess, from what we've seen before, and we're just going to get better and better as the years go on and doing that kind of thing.
Only if you take concussion management for an example, we look at where we've come in the last 5-10 years of that. It's rugby union is, I believe, a world leader in the way that we manage concussions and look after it. So we've shown in the past that we have the ability and we have the people to put the right processes in place, and with the RPA leading the campaign for mental health, I think we'll be in a good place.
Do you think you'll start seeing more roles like yourself at different other clubs? Because as you mentioned, when you first started, it wasn't a league-wide thing. It's not like every club has one of these people to help. Do you think you'll see a lot more of these people get those posts?
I hope so. I like to think so. I think if you look at big corporations and big businesses, they'll have a development arm, they'll have an HR department, they'll have someone that works on the learning and development of their business. So when you're putting so much time and effort and money into these players, every physical need is looked after. Can we look after them pre and post contract? I think that's ultimately what we're looking at. So for us is, can we look after them while we have them here? Can we develop them as best we can while they're here? But also, are we there as a support once they finish? Because they give blood, sweat, and tears for that shirt, don't they? I mean, it's they put a lot into that jersey, and they represent it with great pride. So the least we can do as a rugby club is to help them in the future.
Exactly. Thanks very much, Billy. You've been brilliant.
No worries.
Thank you.
That really was a fantastic interview there with Chris. He's an excellent speaker to start with. I thought it was all very interesting what he was saying. It was really enlightening to see some of the steps that the club is taking towards giving athletes a real chance of having a successful sort of life and career after they've finished their athletic career. We will revisit this all a bit later, the conversation that Chris had with Chris, but I think just to bring a little bit of focus back to the main issue at hand, whilst doing some of the research for this podcast, I managed to accrue sort of 5 or 6 key issues that I think athletes might face after they retire from sport for one reason or another, and potentially don't have quite as much access to someone as brilliant as Chris Bell or the department over at WASPs, and then perhaps don't quite get the career that they would want. So I think the first thing we can talk about perhaps is financial loss. So obviously, athletes come out of their career, they could be mega rich like footballers, or they could be in a very decent standing, but perhaps not completely set for life. So Chris, what do you think about this potential loss of financial stability?
Well, obviously, it's been their main source of income for a long time, and obviously it varies hugely across all the different sports, as you've mentioned, and across even the players within the sports. The amount that certain players are on varies greatly, even within a squad like WASPs. But it is fundamentally, it's been their job, and they don't know how to do anything else, really. So it's difficult for them to even think about not earning the money that they were before and being the breadwinner for their family, and they're going to have to find something else that will be that main source of income. And that's difficult on its own, because we all know that there's financial pressures out there in the world that we have to look out and try and get these jobs. So it must be a stress just having to think about, oh, I'm going to have to do something else now to provide for my family, etc.
I think this particular problem is confined to quite a specific group of athletes. I think if we talk Olympic athletes, especially the guys not right at the top of the game, but the guys who are lottery funded and perhaps don't have the quite as lucrative sponsorship deals that Usain Bolt might have or Tyson Gay, etc. But also not necessarily any more premiership footballers who are on sort of 30 plus grand a week. I think we're looking at rugby is a fantastic example of a sport where a lot of the guys, they earn well, but you know, you only do that for 10 years and then you've really got to sit down and think, right, okay, what's next for me financially? What am I going to do? And to negate it and just say, oh, these guys have just got to go out there and get a job and then earn the money that way, that's not an easy thing to do. You know, students stay out of work for months and months after getting all these fresh sets of skills. So yes, financial loss is potentially something that could happen quite quickly, especially if the athletes continue to spend as they were when they were earning post-career.
Yes, you've got to try and change your lifestyle, haven't you? Because you know that you're not quite at the same level you were before.
So another thing I sort of found was a loss of identity.
Yep.
This is quite a slightly abstract notion for those of us who aren't fortunate enough to be elite athletes. I identify myself as just a normal person, but when you spent so long at the top of your career or being an athlete and that ends for one reason or another, how do you define yourself now?
Yeah, because they've had Wikipedia pages or whatever created for them on the internet. If you search their name, they're going to be down as a footballer or a rugby player, and then they're not going to be there anymore. So it's their entire identity is wrapped up in what they've achieved in their sporting career oftentimes, and once that's over, they're going to have to try and identify them as the ex-professional sportsman, which is, it's a difficult thing to do.
And of course, these sort of issues can then lead to problems with alcohol or perhaps even drug dependency. Not to shine a particular light on any individual, but I think that for most English people, Paul Gascoigne is a particularly poignant example, probably one of the most talented footballers that this country has ever produced, but sadly towards the end of his career and post-career he's struggled with alcohol addiction, and perhaps the loss of identity after he retired as an athlete contributed to that. What do you do when you retire? What motivates you? What gets you out of bed? As an athlete, it's quite obvious what you've got to go and do. You've got to go train, but perhaps when you wake up in the morning and all there is to do is twiddle your thumbs and go to Tesco, perhaps it's not quite as bright a future, and perhaps that can lead you to substance abuse.
Yeah, I think that's a key point that they've had. A lot of these people have had all of their days written out for them by coaches. They've had their time timetabled so that they know what they're doing every second of the day. But when it comes to the end of their career, their time is suddenly their own and they have to fill it with whatever they can. And sometimes that is a struggle on its own, that suddenly they haven't got someone telling them what to do every single day. And that loss of structure can be very difficult in someone's life.
The very next bullet point I've got written down, Chris, is loss of structure. So you've done that superbly well. So yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if you look at swimmers, for instance, or rowers, when they're famously get up at 4 in the morning to go and do a set of laps or get onto the river before, you know, boats fill it up, I suppose.
Yeah.
And these guys, they do their training, they go and do whatever else during the day, hit the gym, etc., etc., and then late in the evening they go back to the pool, they go back to the river, and then they go to bed, and it's just eat, sleep, train, repeat, quite literally.
Yeah.
For these guys, and then they compete whenever appropriate. And if you do that for 15 years and then suddenly it's gone one day, that could leave you feeling quite lost. So it's kind of understandable that these guys would naturally turn to the easiest things to sort of occupy their time, whether that's perhaps gambling,
yeah,
perhaps substance abuse, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Perhaps isolation. So the guys, especially in team sports, when they retire, they'll have spent all their time with all their mates, and their core social group is likely going to be formed around their teammates. And when they're no longer part of that circle and they no longer have the full access to their friends, perhaps that can lead to mental health issues such as depression and loneliness and isolation.
Yes, I had that written down on my list as well, of losing that band of brothers that you feel like you are a family at the club every single day, and that bit of your life suddenly just gets cut out. It is very difficult. You're on WhatsApp groups with these guys, and then as soon as your career ends, you're suddenly kicked out of the WhatsApp group, and that kind of social side of your life is gone as well. And particularly for people that are involved in these fixtures where you have to play every single weekend, people don't really appreciate it, but not being able to go out and see other friends from school or whatever other parts of your life, it makes it difficult because you are with the same guys every single weekend, and the rest of your personal life is kind of on halt as you're having this professional career, and then you've suddenly got to try and pick it up with all of these guys that you've missed out on for the last 10 or whatever years during your professional sports career.
Finally, I think perhaps maybe a lack of competition in day-to-day life could be a bit of a factor that athletes might face, although it's not necessarily a major one that you might think of originally. These guys have been geared up to competing regularly at the highest level and really having that mental edge to win.
Yeah.
And in day-to-day life, that's not something that really exists. And the athletes may use that as a real source of motivation. I want to win this gold. But when they retire, the focus then needs to shift from I need to win to I need to make a new career for myself. And that's hard. That must be hard.
Yeah.
Totally shifting your motivation from something with a very solid end goal to something which, if you ask myself or yourself right now, where's your career going to end up, we can't say, because that's the nature of life, it's fluid. So to give an athlete who's so used to very specific goals something that's very non-specific and very distant, that must be quite difficult.
Yeah, losing that motivation, but not only the motivation, losing in the adrenaline rush that they get every time that they compete must be really difficult for them to try and get that in life in some sort of other way. Competing in front of 20,000 people or whatever every single week is completely unique, and you're going to struggle to get that anywhere else. I know James Cracknell really struggled when he retired from rowing, and he ended up having to try and row the Atlantic with Ben Fogel and doing an ultra marathon in a desert to just try and get
the Tour de Sable.
Yeah, just to try and get that kind of as you say, the motivation and the adrenaline rush back from competing back in his life again. He felt that he had to go out and do that kind of stuff.
That's particularly an issue you'd imagine with athletes who have had their careers cut short by injury. I mean, Chris mentioned in his interview he had a long and fulfilled career, and he left the game when perhaps the time was right. But if you retire at sort of 24, 25 when your career is just on the up, and you lose everything so suddenly, you not only have a lack of financial stability that you would have got had you had a full career, you lose that competition immediately without even thinking about, you know, do I want to do this for my long-term future? Yeah, it just happens. You lose that structure, you lose the focus of your day-to-day life, you lose your identity because you're no longer that elite athlete. So while we say retiring by choice is difficult enough, retiring through injury early on in your career is probably even more devastating.
Oh yeah, it's certainly more difficult when that happens to someone, because they're not as mentally prepared for it, and they probably haven't looked into any sort of options of what they're going to do afterwards, because they're 100% focused on what they're going to be doing for the next 5 years or whatever that they think they were going to have. And obviously, not on top of that, they've got the sheer depression that they've lost that side of their life. So it's very difficult to take for them, and it must be very difficult to turn around into something else straight away.
The notion of preparing brings us very neatly back round to the conversation that you had with Chris. What I really liked about the interview is that it seemed that the intrinsic motivation from a lot of the players in the rugby team was there to have a career post-sport. I mean, he talked about James Gaskell, Matt Simmons, and a lot of the younger guys like Elliot Daly, who have all, you know, they've all started making inroads into their development for a career after sport.
So I think we really are quite lucky in rugby that it is easier to motivate these guys than, say, footballers that were earning $100,000 a week. For the most part, rugby players are a lot better qualified as well from their university careers or whatever they've been able to do before. So there definitely is that extra motivation that these guys show. Just to pick up on one of the guys you mentioned there, James Haskell's extremely driven, varying from DJing to fitness, his fitness business, with various books coming out on that side of things. And obviously we see him regularly on the TV coverage as well for Sky Sports. So he has an incredibly varied repertoire.
He does indeed. So I think we can both accept the Wasps are doing an absolutely fantastic job on, you know, player development post-career, but unfortunately this is not the norm. As Chris alluded to, the Wasps is one of the few rugby clubs that do it. But I think that it's evident from what Chris was saying that player education is probably the most important factor for determining what the athlete is going to be doing post-career, whether that's education in the traditional sense of going off to uni, getting some qualifications, or education in the sense that, you know, early on when these guys are in academies, even starting even that far back, that you need to say to them, okay, right guys, football or rugby, hockey, cricket, whatever it is going to be, this is going to be your life for the next 12 years. But at the same time, you really need to think about what happens after you finish, what happens if you get injured, all these sort of things. So make sure you keep your eyes open for opportunities, really have a think about what you might like to do, whether that is in media. If so, why don't you get involved in social media right now? Why don't you go and learn how to edit videos, edit podcasts in your off time, on your off days, rather than sitting at home playing FIFA?
Yeah, I think it's really important the roles that bodies like the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association, or the RPA, the Rugby Players Association, as we mentioned in the talk with Belly, the role that they play with the players as well, because they've obviously got fantastic experience league-wide on in these instances as well, where they can help educate these players that they do need to be doing more. And not only that, they can help sort the courses for them. So it's not just the players having to go out and try and do it individually, they can go and do it as a collective, which we are quite lucky with Wasps. There are a number of players that are interested in the same sort of thing, so we can get five guys going out to go and do a course together, and it is the RPA and Belly and having that sort of structure helping them that really makes that easier for them.
Yes, as we say, there is lots of good work in isolated parts, and hopefully this will become a nice trend that we see throughout sport, really preparing athletes for a future post-career. So Chris, just to finish off, I think it'd be nice to have a look at some of the guys who have not necessarily gone straight into media and punditry post-career. So what sporting examples can you give of athletes who have gone on to have interesting careers post-retirement?
Well, there's been some incredibly interesting examples. There's obviously George Foreman with his lean, mean grilling machine. We've had Thomas Gravesen, the Everton midfielder, who formed that attritional partnership, shall we say, with Lee Carsley in the early 2000s. He's gone on to be a professional poker player in Las Vegas. And we've had, obviously, the one of the most famous examples, Vinnie Jones, who's gone on to being an actor in Hollywood afterwards. And Dave Whelan, who now is an owner at a football club, having made his money from a small grocery chain that he bought, having ended his football career early. He bought that for £400 and sold it for £1.5 million, then flipped that into a fishing store and turned that into the second largest sporting goods retailer in Great Britain, which was JJB Sports or DW Sports, and then obviously managed to buy his hometown club, Wigan. So that was a definite success story.
Yes, certainly a few right there. Also, Michael Jordan, not that he's ever going to be strapped for cash, but his brand of footwear and all that sort of stuff. So some nice examples of athletes using the money, the capital that they have, to invest in appropriate ventures in the future, or indeed just turning to something completely different, like the grill. Anyway, Chris, I think that's enough for today. It was an absolute pleasure to have Chris Bell on the podcast this week. He really did give us a fascinating insight into the world of not only rugby, but into the world of player development for a career pro sport. Don't forget to find us on all our social media at @dugout_debate on Twitter and on Facebook. And why don't you check out our website, www.dugoutdebatepodcast.com, for more extra reading on all of the topics that we cover in every podcast. That's it from me, Tim Husbury.
That's it from me, Chris Kerr.
See you next time.